Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following episode will mention explicit and sensitive topics which may be disturbing to some people, especially to the young audience. Do not proceed if necessary. Hello, campers. I heard everyone had fun time listening to the story narration that we recently did. So I'm giving it another go and give you another story from Carlos Palanca Memorial Awards for Literature and Philippine National Book Awardee, Miss Eliza Victoria. The world we're going into is the world of a simple town called Maharlika, where everyone has unique gifts brought to them by a race of merfolk inhabiting the town's river. But what would happen when a murderer comes into this perfect town? This is the Philippine Camper Stories production of Eliza Victoria's Siren Song. Part 1. Magic fled from the small town of Maharlika on the night a woman's bloody torso was found near the river. Gerardo Nagtahan, one-third of Maharlika's entire police force, stood in paralyzed horror when he chanced upon the half-body during his nightly rounds. Gerardo knew everyone in the town, and the woman, celestially beautiful with cream-colored skin and the hair the color of gold, wasn't anyone he knew. A stranger, his thoughts scattered and manic, at once focused and went to that other stranger, Roland Leviste, who lived in a rented house at the edge of the town. Roland remained a stranger in Maharlika, despite the fact that he had lived there for more than a year. Now, Gerardo felt a sad vindication. They shouldn't have accepted that man. They should have driven him away. They should have banished him in the moment they laid eyes on him and saw his past. Saw what he did to those poor girls. They should have listened to me, Gerardo thought. That was when Gerardo realized he couldn't listen. The town awoke early and went to bed early. And at night, when everything was silent, save for the sound of frogs and river songs, he could sometimes hear the residents in their sleep, hear snatches of a dream, a whispered prayer. And most of all, the river. The river was eerily silent, devoid of song. Gerardo looked past the torso and saw several feet away the woman's bottom half, gleaming in the blue moonlight, buoyed by the river. Gerardo could have screamed, but instead, he fell to his knees. It was a severed mermaid's tail. Part 2. Many believe the word Maharlika referred to the nobility, but in fact, it referred to the nobility's warriors. The nobility were called the Maginoo, and the Maharlika were bound to serve them in battle. In 1569, however, in a small coastal town in central Luzon, the Maharlika sheathed their swords and the Maginoo did not cry for war. Instead, they waited for the Spaniards to reach their land and embraced them and dined with them as though they were long-lost kin. In the next 2 years, Salcedo and de Goiti repaid their hospitality by fighting Raja Sulaiman and eventually conquering the Kingdom of Maynila. When Salcedo went back with his forces to the small town to claim it for Spain, the Maharlika were already waiting for him, swords now unsheathed. The Spaniards won, but it was a near slaughter. It was the bloodiest battle the young conquistador had ever fought. It was widely believed that the wounds Salcedo suffered in that small town contributed to his early death at the age of 27. He named the town Villa Isabella, after the Spanish queen. Only two or three peninsulares stayed behind to live in that small town, and all of them left after a couple of weeks. They said night after night they heard strange sounds coming from the river, and the sounds like angry songs, like cries of rebuke, wouldn't let them sleep. They believe the town was a cursed place. Part 3. On June 1, 1863, Doña Clara de Luna, a young mestiza married to the cabeza de barangay, woke up to the insides of her head, vibrating like a taut wire. It was Monday, the day before the new fraile, bless his heart, talked at length about the lost and ignorant citizens of Villa Isabella and the town's evil heir. Villa Isabella changed town priests as often as twice a month. The frailes couldn't stay too long. Most of them got sick as soon as they arrived. Constant change in church leadership caused inciting among the churchgoers, including Doña Clara, who dutifully sat beside her husband on the front pew every Sunday, fanning herself in the oppressive heat, wishing the current priest would stay longer than his predecessor. Her anxiety increased tenfold when the new priest suddenly paused in the middle of his sermon, paced around the pulpit, stopped, and said,
"Tila kayo'y nakaligtaan na ng Diyos."
It appears that you have been forgotten by God. How horrible a thought. Doña Clara went to sleep that night and had a frightening dream about an earthquake. A church reduced to rubble. The faithful trapped beneath the ruins. "This is that frailes' fault," she thought upon waking, and immediately recited a Padre Nuestro to wash away the sinful reflection. But the entire day, the images in her dream burned themselves deeper in her mind. Her constant worrying gave her a fever and confined her to her room. The house of the Cabeza de Barangay overlooked the river, but even the sight of the sparkling current through the window and the cool air did nothing to calm her nerves. When her husband asked her how she was, she wanted to say, "I am waiting for the earth to start shaking." On Tuesday, she sat alone in the dining room and tried to enjoy her breakfast. She nibbled on the bread and had a bit of egg yolk, but her stomach recoiled, refusing them. Doña Clara raised her hand to pick up her glass of milk, but before she could do so, the glass of milk, like an obedient child, slid across the gleaming tabletop and rested against her open palm. Doña Clara screamed and dropped the glass in horror. Warm milk splashed against her legs and she jumped up and stepped away from the cursed object. One of the maids rushed into the room. "Señora," she said,
"the glass moved."
Doña Clara wanted to say,
"The glass moved and reached my hand on its own."
But she couldn't say a word. On June 3, 1863, a strong earthquake hit Manila and destroyed several buildings, including the Manila Cathedral. Buried beneath the destroyed church were three singers, four choir boys, nine members of the cathedral chapter, and an undetermined number of people who attended the rites of the celebration of Corpus Christi. Doña Clara heard the news from her husband and listened to the story that came to her in a dream 2 days before. A story she already knew. When no one was looking, she would will an object to move. For a door to close, for a pillow to turn itself, and it would move. In July, she began to have dreams of Villa Isabella with no peninsulares, no forced labor, no extraordinary taxes. In the air was that intense sense of liberation. She dreamt of the river, of a kind woman submerged in the water. She dreamt of a single word, Maharlika. But she also dreamt of three priests killed via the garrote. Soldiers marching to their deaths. Women getting raped and brutally killed by strange men with white skin. Her dreams scared Doña Clara because she knew they were beyond her time. Way beyond her time. They were scenes that would happen after her death.
Tila ako'y nakaligtaan na ng Diyos.
She thought, because she couldn't understand his power, and she believed this power didn't come from God, but from his dark adversary. There were times, however, when she would wonder why any hint of power and control was always attributed to the Diablo, while silence and weakness was considered a godly trait. Was that how she was supposed to live? To suffer and suffer and suffer and suffer. One night, she dreamt of the river again and a kind woman. This time, the woman, black-haired and beautiful, emerged from the water and crawled to the shore. Crawled because instead of legs, the woman had a tail of a fish. The woman's breasts were bare. Doña Clara was afraid the mermaid woman would die if she stayed out of the water for too long, so she ran to her before the woman could crawl any further. The mermaid looked up, grateful. She sat up and kept the lower half of her body in the river. Doña Clara knelt in front of her, felt the wet soak through her skirt. The mermaid touched Doña Clara's face, neck, breast. The mermaid's hands were as cool as the river's current, and Doña Clara gasped in surprise, and then pleasure. The mermaid lowered her hands, and Doña Clara began to cry. "This is not a dream," she thought. "This is not a dream, is it?" The mermaid smiled and shook her head. Behind her, around her, the river came alive with tiny waves, arms and hair, and flapping tails.
"Clara."
The mermaid's voice echoed in her mind, soft and soothing.
"Wake up."
The residents of Villa Isabella stirred from sleep. Some of them, like Clara, would have the gift of foresight and the ability to move things from afar. Some of them would be able to spontaneously start fire. Some of them would be able to manipulate water. And some of them, the new fraile, the peninsulares, those who did not have roots in the land would flee the town the next day, having awakened from a most disturbing dream. Throughout her life, Doña Clara would write her predictions and observations in a leather-bound book that once served as her diary. The diary would remain in the De Luna mansion, but would be available for the perusal of the entire town after her death. One of the last entries in the book was entitled, Ang Kasagraduhan ng Serena sa Bayan ng Maharlika, Sacredness of Mermaids in the Town of Maharlika. Unfortunately, only the cover page of the entry remained. The rest of the pages had been torn out. Her relatives theorized that she might have kept the pages somewhere in her room or in the library, but they were never found. Part 4. Roland Leviste had been plagued with nightmares from the moment he arrived in Maharlika with a small bag of clothes and a battered pair of rubber shoes. But then, he had always been plagued with nightmares. Never in his life had he had a good night's sleep, except, perhaps, during the nights he killed. The last girl who died in his hands was the college student who kept screaming, "Don't rape me," as a joke. She treated everything as a joke. Her laughter grated against his eardrums. They were in some seedy motel room with a caught-up sofa and stained sheets and a cracked mirror. It was possible that the girl could scream rape all she wanted, and no one would have come. Roland panicked and hit her in the stomach. She fell doubled up on the floor, and he hit her on the side of the head. Roland was unnerved. He should have drugged the girl before bringing her to the motel. He drugged all of his victims before cutting them up. It was the cutting that he wanted. The elegant sawing through skin and muscle and fat and bone. The blood squirting on his face and pooling around his legs as his muse slept. Not this. Not this direct contact. Not this violence. But the girl had seen his face. And so, he had to go through with it. He had to stop before he could finish doing it. He threw down his tools and ran to the roach-infested bathroom to throw up, peel off his blood-spattered clothes, and bathe. For the next several months, Roland traveled from one city to another, jumping from one job to the next, and not be able to kill. At various times during a single day, he would stop at what he was doing, cleaning a car, tending a counter, wiping a table, and cry into his hands. His bosses and colleagues pitied him. In their heads, they created a story for Roland's life. Orphan, widower, abandoned father. Finally, one morning, Roland got up and jumped on a bus that would take him away from the city. On the side of a dirt road, he approached a pila of tricycles and asked to be taken deeper into the town. They refused. "Tagalabas ka, no?" a cigarette-puffing old man said. "Wala hong sasakyang pumapasok sa karsadang yan." Roland asked why, but none of them answered. He decided to walk. After an hour of walking, Roland saw the startling blue of the river and the deep green of the trees, and knew at once in his heart that he would never kill again. When Roland knocked on the first door he saw to ask for shelter and food, a murmur passed across the minds of the residents of Maharlika.
Bakit nandito yan? Bakit mamamatay tao yan?
Paalisin niyo.
Turn him away. The horrified voice of Gerardo Nagtahan said. They saw Roland's victim as they were hacked to death, the scenes passing and convulsing like a dying eel in a current. It was Catalino Reyes, the town's oldest resident and Maharlika's barangay captain, who calmed down Gerardo and tried to quell the fear and indignation rising in Maharlika. He felt Roland's despair, his need for forgiveness, his want of a new beginning. He opened the door. Roland couldn't understand why everyone in the small town seemed unapproachable. In the market, where he found work as a fish vendor in Catalina's son's stall, he couldn't make buyers to stop to chat with him, no matter how cheerful he sounded. Catalina's son almost always seemed to have a headache whenever he spoke with him.
"Don't mind him," Catalina said.
"This town is not used to outsiders."
Other than Catalino, only Anton de Luna, a descendant of Doña Clara and roughly Roland's own age, took the time to make Roland feel at home. Anton was a town teacher and librarian. He held regular classes in one of the rooms in the De Luna mansion and helped people track books in the family library. Some of the books were donated by the oldest families in town and dated back to the 1600s. Roland was invited to take a look, but the older books were off-limits to him, for some reason. In the beginning, Roland kept inviting him to his rented apartment for a drink, but Anton always refused, citing for his stomachache. Anton had stomachaches every night, it appeared, and Roland eventually stopped his invitations. The man was nice to him, but Roland got the point.
"They don't want outsiders," Anton said once. "Because they don't want to put up a show in their own town. This is their home, not a stage. They don't want to become performers and play pretend in their own home." "I don't understand,"
Roland said.
"Why do they have to pretend? Everyone lapses into a performance at some point,"
Anton said.
"One way or another."
And Roland felt frightened. It felt as though Anton had looked into his mind and saw everything that he was trying to hide. The week before the mermaid was found, Roland had a recurring dream. The dream came to him every day for 7 days. In the dream, he was sitting by the river, and a beautiful woman with dark hair was talking to him.
"What do you want?
What do you want?
I want to cleanse myself.
Come join me in the water.
In the water."
Always, Roland would refuse, because he knew that if he joined her, he would cut her in half. Immediately after Gerardo found the dead mermaid, the residents of Maharlika rushed to Roland's rented house and descended upon him like a tidal wave. There were some residents of Maharlika who could turn a man's bones to powder with a single glance, but that power was gone now. It did not stop them. Blind with fury, lost without their lost gifts, they drag him out of his bed and out to the doorway, not caring if his head hit the ground or the steps. They hit him with fists and sticks and rocks. They tore out his hair and scratched his face and peeled off his skin. By the time they had strung him up a tree with a rope, he was no longer recognizable. With his swollen tongue and his gouged-out eyes, they left him there to be fed to the birds. It was Anton de Luna who caught him down the next morning and buried him in the soil beneath the tree. Part 5. Amanda de Luna was surrounded by the people who wanted to disappear. While Roland was being ravaged to death by his crazed neighbors, Amanda was walking around the university oval, papers in hand, trying to memorize a poem for one of her classes. Around her were students and alumni, glistening with sweat, running in the near dark. Somewhere among them was Clarissa, who for days had complained about her waist and her thighs and leg muscles and her speed.
"I look like a sack of rice,"
Clarissa said. Amanda imagined Clarissa would run until she was depleted, shrunken, no more. After their parents died, she left her older brother in Maharlika and went to the university. Though her brother mailed her checks every month or so, she paid her own fees by providing proofreading services to a group of Koreans. She used the checks only during emergencies, or when she was too saddled with schoolwork to proofread for money. She wanted to cut her ties from the stifling small town that nobody has heard of, nobody wanted to go to, and where she had lived like a stone for 16 years. There were things that she missed: the Sunday breakfast and the big Spanish house with her brother's students. Their house was the only school in Maharlika, and her brother its only teacher. The wet market jutting like a lip over the river. Various species of fish being sold in the stalls. The river itself with its perfect sapphire hue. The mermaids who swam to the shore and gave her shells and rough pearls as gifts. And her brother. Her soft-spoken Guy Anton could hardly contain his thunderstorm of a sister. Amanda knew she had to leave while she could still think of Maharlika with nostalgia before she could hate it. The mermaid's gifts followed her out of town. While her brother settled comfortably with precognition and psychometry, my brother could read people pretty well, she'd tell her city friends. From a very early age, Amanda herself had to go through a whole slew of abilities for several years before she could settle. At the age of 2, she discovered that she was able to bilocate. A boon for hide and seek, but a bane for her playmates and her parents. She dropped that quickly after only a few months and gained remote viewing. Then pyrokinesis. Then transfection. There was a year in her life where she could see into another room without leaving hers, create fire from thin air, and fly. However, she dropped all three at the age of 14 and gained precognition, retrocognition, remote influencing, and frighteningly strong telekinesis. She thought that she would never settle. There were residents, barely spoken of, who would demonstrate one ability in the morning and lose it in the afternoon. She was worried she was going to be one of them. But she turned 16, grew moodier, and settled with all four gifts. She was happy with them. Sometimes she would see horrible things that she couldn't immediately understand, but she was happy to be able to protect herself without depending on anyone for help. Once she was walking in the city and a man groped her breast. She broke his arm bone in 3 places with a single glance. Once she sensed a robbery occurring in a building across the street while she was in a bookstore, and she influenced the man to put down their weapons and face the wall until the police arrived. It was her habit to walk home in the dead of the night and commute while carrying considerable amounts of cash, and she did so without fear. She would answer leers from strange men with an unblinking stare. She had been stopped by men with ice picks or guns, and every time she would smile and feel pleasure in her invulnerability and a man's false beliefs in theirs. They simply did not know what they had gotten themselves into. In the past, whenever she dropped an ability, she would feel incomplete, unsafe, as though she had been left naked in a sea of strangers. Amanda stopped dead in her tracks. Clarissa, who was about to make her turn, saw her and stopped as well. "Amanda," she said, wiping sweat off her face. "Are you okay?" It took Amanda a long time to reply. "I need to go home," she said. Part 6. She would have left right then and there, but Amanda believed she had lost her shield. There was no electricity and no phone lines in Maharlika, so she couldn't contact her brother. The question burned within her, but she had no choice. She had to wait for daybreak. She curled on her side of the bed that night, wide awake, wondering. She left early the next day. She decided not to wake Clarissa. After a moment's hesitation, she swiped Clarissa's pepper spray off the bedside table and placed it in her bag. In the darkness of the bus, she sat anxious and angry and frustrated, her knee jackknifing, her arms embracing her bag, her wet palms leaving prints on the fabric. The lines of tricycles on the side of the dirt road was conspicuously absent. The walk home felt longer than usual. The path was deserted. As Amanda walked toward Maharlika, She saw farmlands filled with stalks of palay turned brown by the sun. The trees had shed their leaves and appeared to be dying. In place of the loud chorus of crickets and frogs and birds, she could only hear the howling wind and the eerie buzzing of flies. It wasn't long before she found a dead cow on the side of the road. Maharlika looked like a ghost town. Every window and door in every house was closed, and the market, which usually roared with activity, was silent.
Tao po,
she said, but there was no answer. Amanda walked over the river and became very conscious on the sound of gravel crunching beneath her feet. The water was the color of charcoal, gray and death beneath a gray sky. Again, buzzing flies. On the shore was a small square space covered with coconut leaves. On the leaves were fruits and raw meat arranged on a large bilao. But the mangoes and guavas and papayas were already decaying. The pieces of chicken and cow already bled dry by the sun and covered by flies and maggots. What were the offerings for?
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Amanda knelt by the water and dip her hand into the river.
Amanda!
What?
Amanda!
The sound came from behind her. Before Amanda could turn, something broke through the surface of the water and lunged at her hand. Amanda recoiled, screamed. The creature emitted a high-pitched sound that hurt her ears, but Amanda still couldn't stop screaming. Her heels displaced gravel as she pushed herself back in a frantic attempt to escape. She was still screaming when Anton came to her side and covered her eyes. The thing beneath the water had sharp fangs and red eyes and claws and a mermaid's tail. Part 7. The metamorphosis occurred immediately. The mutilated mermaid was moved to the church for the burial. During the transit, she transformed into a mound of fine white dust, like a starfish removed from the ocean. Not long after, a boat capsized while passing through the river, and three fishermen were reduced to blood and bones. Maharlika soon discovered that the mermaids had lost their human features and had developed a taste for human flesh. The mermaids, in their present monstrous incarnation, could no longer sing. The river had been emptied of fish, as though the fish had disappeared along with the mermaid's song. The following day, the mermaids started mating, emitting howls like a gathering storm. Maharlika covered its ears. When the mermaids were done, the offspring they produced were a far cry from the mermaid broods that once swam the shallow waters of the river with their scaly backs and tiny fins. Amanda used to watch them, she remembered. Those tiny mermaids swimming in a single group, a rainbow-colored band transversing the river. Now, the water was filled with blobs of transparent eggs, inside of which were fish red in color and the shape and the size of piranhas. Their mouths wouldn't stop opening and closing, and the sound they emitted sounded like the cries of human babies. They drove the town mad. The residents' powers were gone forever, but not the memories of what they had seen, glimpses of the future. A person's true nature. In the final town meeting, before the residents locked themselves up in their homes, and before he killed himself by throwing himself into the river, Catalino Reyes asked the once clairvoyant if they had seen this coming. Nobody did.
Nobody?
Amanda echoed, sitting at the same table where more than 100 years ago, Doña Clara summoned a glass of milk.
I made some tea for you,
Anton said, and placed a cup in front of her along with a plate of fruits and bread. He was wearing a crisp, white button-up shirt, the sleeves rolled up neatly to his elbows, and gray slacks. He was always a teacher, even without students. After closing all the windows, Anton turned on the gas lamp. With the dining room filled with the soft yellow light, Amanda could make believe it was evening, and her parents were just in the kitchen supervising dinner.
I still have fish in stock,
Anton said.
But I don't think you'd be in a good mood to eat fish right now, huh? Do you want me to fry some eggs?
Amanda shook her head.
The house help had left. Manang Loring said she has a sister in Batangas who can take her in for the meantime. This town is going to be abandoned,
Amanda said. And Don patted her hand.
We'll be all right,
he said and smiled.
Maybe I can go live with you now.
Amanda's hand trembled beneath his brother's.
I need to tell you something.
You're living with a girl?
That gave Amanda pause.
What?
I had a vision,
Anton said.
Before you left for the city? It was all symbols, but overwhelming message I got was, you are with a girl. I knew her name had a hard K sound, but I could only sense softness in her.
Clarissa,
Amanda said, and suddenly felt sad.
That's her name?
Anton said.
That sounds right.
For a moment, Amanda couldn't think of anything to say.
You're happy with her?
Anton said. Amanda couldn't reply. She was thinking of her parents again. That cloudless morning when their father, an empath, left town for the city to meet a friend. Anton was confined to his bed, writhing from a searing pain in his stomach. They would learn the next day that their father had been found dead in a hotel room. Rat poison, they said. He died alone miles away from his wife and children, surrounded by strangers.
Why did he do it, mother?
Amanda once asked, and her mother said,
because he was born into this world to suffer and suffer and suffer, and he didn't want to suffer anymore.
Their mother chose to suffer in his stead and died in a fall after deciding that she, too, had had enough.
Do you still get stomach pains?
Amanda asked. And Don closed his eyes as though suddenly blinded.
Every night,
he said.
And now?
Anton shook his head.
I knew you were an empath,
Amanda said.
I knew it that night, even if you didn't list that in the town register.
And Dawn said nothing.
Is that why you did it?
And Dawn reached for her hand once again, but she drew back.
Amanda, he said.
I had a vision of you. Years before father died.
Amanda said.
I couldn't decipher it then. You were older. You were in a dirty kitchen with another man who looked really scared. And he was watching you cut a large fish in half.
I didn't know.
And Tom began. Amanda was already shaking in anger.
Amanda!
And Tom began again.
I didn't know the rest of the mermaids would become that way after a mermaid death. I didn't know the river would die.
And if you did?
Amanda said, trying to sniff back her tears.
If you did, would you have done it differently?
And Dawn didn't answer.
That man the town hanged was innocent,
she said.
He was a murderer,
and Dawn said.
He killed girls your age. So that makes it all right to throw him to the angry mob? Did you know that they peeled off his skin?
Amanda.
Don't touch me.
Amanda jumped to her feet away from her brother as though Anton had turned into that creature in the river that almost bit off her hand.
How dare you do this to us? How will I ever feel safe again?
I'm sorry,
Anton said, now crying.
I was hurting. The hell with you,
Amanda said. She lifted a plate from the table and threw it on the floor. It crashed upon impact and created a loud sound inside the room.
Father hurt. Mother hurt. But they never...
Would you rather I have killed myself?
Amanda couldn't hold back any longer. She burst into tears.
But I couldn't,
Anton said.
I was hurting, but I couldn't kill myself. Amanda.
Amanda couldn't speak through her tears.
I'm a coward, Amanda,
Anton said.
I'm sorry.
Part 8. There was no rule about the murder of mermaids because no one in town would even think of doing them harm. Why would anyone do so? The mermaids were kind and peaceful and kept the river teeming with fish. Harming the mermaids was so unfathomable that no one even bothered to ask what the punishment could be for such a crime. Unknown to the residents, Doña Clara wrote about this forbidden topic in her missing entry, which Anton found by accident in the library after Amanda's departure from Maharlika. The pages, folded and hidden in an old town register that was in turn buried in an avalanche of books, had become yellow and fragile with age, but the ink was preserved enough for Anton to decipher the words. Harming, but not killing, a mermaid, it said, would mean retaliation. The perpetrator would be pulled to the depths of the river by the merfolk and punished so severely that even his bones would not be found. His family, up to the seventh generation, would no longer receive powers. Since the mermaid's arrival to Maharlika, there have been 3 cases of this foul crime, which, to Doña Clara's opinion, was 3 cases too many. The perpetrators indeed disappeared and their families lost their powers, but there was no proof that everyone down to the 7th generation lost theirs as well. Old Testament sensibility, Anton thought as he read. Clara simply couldn't get rid of herself, of the Catholic in her. Killing a mermaid, on the other hand, the piece continued, would affect not only the perpetrator and his family, but the entire town as well. Upon the murder of a mermaid, every single resident of Maharlika would lose their power and would not regain them until the end of their days. And until the end of their line, they would be as they were before the mermaids came with their gifts.
Ang pagpatay sa sirena ay pagpatay na rin sa sarili.
To kill a mermaid is to kill the self. In the depths of his despair, Anton begged to differ. Anton saw Roland's murderous nature even before Roland saw it himself. Anton, 13, was cutting up potatoes with his sister in the kitchen when a vision came to him like a punch in the gut. He was just cutting up potatoes when all of a sudden he saw the kitchen through the eyes of a man in his early 20s. A stranger to him. And the potatoes turned into a young woman. The sink was filled to the brim with blood. Anton never forgot this vision. If you wanted to lose your power, Anton thought, night after night after he lost his father, then it would be better to kill a mermaid than to harm one. To harm a mermaid meant disappearance, and that would be like putting a mark on yourself. To kill one would mean remaining with a crowd. But how to stay away from the wrath of the town? Anton needed an alibi. When he finally met Roland, he shook his hand as though he were a long-lost friend. Roland was two people, and Anton mourned one of them. The kind, innocent man he cut down from the tree and buried with tears in his eyes. The murderer he removed from his mind and threw to the bottom of the river. Part 9. Anton opened the door for one neighbor who asked for a cup of sugar, and before long, there were six people in the spacious living room, drinking coffee and sharing bread. Amanda sat in one corner, silent, and smiled only when a neighbor acknowledged her presence.
"It's kind for you to come see your brother after what happened,"
they said, and Anton smiled, and Amanda smiled, and both of them said nothing. An old man named Raphael said,
"There are rumors going around saying that the mermaids would form feet and we'd have to hack them to pieces as they left the water."
Raphael's wife crossed herself.
"We can't allow ourselves to worry about things we're not sure of,"
Anne replied. Anne was one of Anton's students.
"But what if it happens?
Perhaps we can look for Doña Clara's diary?"
Amanda saw her brother look at her. "If you want to tell the truth," he seemed to say, "do it now." Amanda looked at her feet.
"I've tried looking for it for years,"
Anton said.
"It's not here."
Anton walked with a group to the front door. Before she stepped out of the house, Aling Maria, Anne's mother, touched his arm and whispered,
"Your stomach isn't bothering you?"
She was not used to seeing Anton up and about at night.
"No,"
Anton said.
"Me too,"
Aling Maria said and smiled.
"We are of the same mold as your parents, bless her heart. I feel nothing now but my own pain."
"Let's go, mother,"
Anne said, her hand on her hip. They left. Amanda stood by the doorway, repeating the words in her head.
"I feel nothing now but my own pain."
Anton and Amanda parted ways after that, and in a house so big, it was not a difficult thing to do. After an hour, however, Amanda got spooked by the high ceiling and the inhuman sounds coming from behind a window and went to go look for her brother. Anton was in the kitchen, making dinner. At the moment, he was cutting up potatoes. On the stove, something fragrant was simmering. Her brother didn't notice her watching. When Amanda approached the kitchen island, Anton jumped a little. Without a word, Amanda took a knife and a chopping board and chopped up the garlic. She felt her brother begin to relax beside her. They prepared dinner side by side in silence. They had done this many times before.
"Maybe you can stay with us,"
Amanda said.
"I'll tell Clarissa. You can work as the teacher there. You'll earn more." They won't pay in chickens.
Amanda saw Anton smile as he stirred soup. Part 10. Magic. Amanda thought of flying across the market, her father's frightened face, the sound of applause. A broom moving on its own as she rearranged her books at the foot of her bed. The heat in her palms as she held on a stick. The sudden bloom of fire. Magic. Amanda thought of clear skies and stars, steamed rice and fish, bagoong soaked in vinegar, a cup of coffee in the early morning, the feel of grass, the city lights. Clarissa. Her brother carrying her on his back, her parents dancing on the cool patio as it rained. The ground pounding with life. A poem humming in her head. You just heard the Philippine Camphor Stories production of Elisa Victoria's Siren Song from her 2012 book entitled A Bottle of Storm Clouds, published by Fistprint Inc. You can find yourselves lost in her many other stories in her more recent book entitled 17 Prayers to the Many-Eyed Mother by Avenida Publishing House. Her latest book is a collection of masterfully curated stories about a young woman who agrees to make a blood sacrifice in exchange for an American visa. Strangers who found themselves stuck in a fatal time loop in a convenience store, and a diwata who agreed to have their wings surgically removed in hopes of assimilation into human society. You can read all these stories and more when you get a copy of her book through myavenida.com, or you can check out more information from the author's website, elisavictoria.com. More information can be seen at these episodes' show notes. Thank you to Elisa Victoria for lending her story for us to enjoy today in this episode. Lastly, thanks to you, dear camper, for listening to the Philippine Camper Stories. This is your Camp Master. See you again in the next episode.
This podcast may be based on true events with names, characters, and incidents that are either products of the creator's imagination or used fictitiously. Any similarity to real individuals or events is coincidental.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.